Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 FM. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a man whose entire life changed after a mosquito bite. And in just a moment, we'll hear from the sponsor of the Arizona Starter Homes Act. But first, Felipe Torres Medina is a writer for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. But not so long ago, the prestige and excitement of life as a TV writer felt like a distant reality to him. Medina came to the U.S. as an immigrant, and like many immigrants, he had to navigate a Byzantine bureaucratic structure that seemed, at various points in the process, designed to keep him out of the country. In his new book, America, Let Me In, Medina lampoons the absurdities of the immigration system by presenting it as a choose-your-own-adventure-style game. I spoke to him recently.
I am an immigrant from Colombia, originally, and so my experience is one of the many paths that you can take in the book. I came here to study in the U.S. I got my master's in screenwriting, and then I got a what they call an alien of extraordinary ability visa, which is a kind of kooky term that the government
I can't believe invented. It was actually called that.
Oh, it is actually called that. It's still very
oh, it still
much
calls
like one
that.
Of the most.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's still called that. I actually now, I've given up on my extraordinary alien status by getting married and I have a green card.
Okay. Your goal in this book is to add a little bit of comedy to your own experience. Mm-hmm. That would suggest, I suppose, that there were some things about your experience that were distinctly uncomedic.
Yeah, I mean, the whole process is Kafka-esque at its best, you know?
Yeah.
So at least for me, as a, you know, a person who is a comedian, it's unavoidable to find comedy in the contradictions within the system. Every person who's getting any kind of visa, be it a tourist visa or, you know, this alien of extraordinary ability visa, once you go get your visa stamped by a person in the embassy, you have to fill out this form online. And it's called the DS-160 form. And this form is very long and it asks some very silly questions that sound silly, but they have to ask them, you know. So they ask you, like, you know, what's your parents' names and how many times have you been to the US? Give us like the exact dates of when you were here, blah, blah, blah. Oh, also, have you ever been a part of a terrorist organization or have you ever been part of human trafficking? And there's an element of comedy there for me of like, obviously, you can't lie in these, but
right.
Who's clicking yes?
Right. You know? I didn't think they were going to ask.
got so close.
Yeah,
so close. And then the other funny thing is that the website crashes about every like 27 minutes.
Oh boy.
And so you have to save your progress. And if you don't, you have to start again. It takes you like a whole afternoon to fill out this form. And then when you're done, you have to print it out.
What?
Then why did you make me fill it out online?
Wait, why do you have to print it out?
Because you have to take it to the embassy to show it to the embassy officer.
Oh my God.
But there's no way to just upload it and they can pull it up on their computer. You just have to do this thing for 4 hours on your computer and then print it out and bring it to the person.
Wow. You came to the U.S., as you mentioned, to study screenwriting. But as I understand it, you have always been comedically inclined. When did you first notice that you had that voice available to you as a way of communicating?
I was always the kid who like gathers your family and puts the chairs around and it's like, you know, it's Christmas, but I'm doing a bit, you know, and I'm doing a performance.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So I was always like doing impressions for my family and really like impressions of Colombian presidents that have been presidents before I was born.
I know that Colombia has a fraught political history when it comes to authoritarianism and terror and people being disappeared and things like that. Was that somewhere in the DNA of your thought process about trying to bring
some amount of levity to a situation that, you know, viewed through a less comedic lens could be sort of bleak.
I think Latin American people are generally very funny.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might be because of what you're mentioning. I think we have to deal with the realities of authoritarianism or terror or crime. Honestly, like in many times sponsored by the United States, you know, like
right.
especially in the case of authoritarianism and dictatorships in Latin America.
Yeah.
So there is an element of life goes on and you must live life. That joy is an act of resistance, not to sound very trite, but it's true. You know, joy is being alive is the one thing that authoritarians wish you weren't.
Right. Yeah. Well, okay. So that is an excellent segue to the format of the book, which you alluded to a moment ago, which is this almost choose your own adventure sort of structure. How did you get the idea for that format, and why did it feel right to you for this?
I wanted to write a lot of immigrant stories. Like, I didn't feel like my story was going to be enough to communicate what I wanted to communicate. I was kind of frustrated. I lived in New York, and I was kind of frustrated having to explain to all my like very progressive, like liberal friends, like all the processes that I was going through uh-huh. with my immigration process. I was like, these people, everyone has an opinion about immigration and no one knows how it works.
Uh-huh.
whatever side you're on, progressive, liberal, conservative, MAGA, whatever it is, everyone has an opinion, but no one has any idea how the system works. So I was like, I want to talk about all the ways that I've thought of or experienced or know of friends who have gone through the process that people can come here. And I knew I wanted to be funny. And so I ended up landing on this kind of interactive method where you're like, you're the character and you're experiencing the different paths.
It almost feels like you're poking fun at the fact that a lot of anti-immigration folks, that's language that they use, that immigrants are trying to game the system. And
yeah, I call it Schrodinger's immigrant. I did not come up with the term, but it's this idea of like immigrants are coming here to take all our jobs, but at the same time, immigrants are coming here because they're lazy and don't want to work and want to take all the government benefits. So so it's this vision of this joint vision of what immigrants are and can be. And so by adding this playfulness, I wanted to just like demystify all that stuff.
Right.
And be like, it cannot be both. So how about you experience it and let me know what you think after experiencing it?
I know that one of the other things that is important to you about this project and that is encoded into the existence of the project in the first place is the idea that people are coming to this country as a choice. Why is that important to you?
I think choosing where to live is a huge act of love. I sometimes describe your home country like your family. It's got its problems, but you love it. Your choice country, if you choose to move to another country or even to another city, that's a decision you made. So it's a little bit more similar to romantic love or to friendship. And so understanding that the people who come here made a choice, an act of love, actually makes us want to reframe all of immigration.
Yeah. Well, Felipe Torres Medina is the author of the new book, America, Let Me In. And he is also a writer for The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. Felipe, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
The bill in the state legislature, known as the Arizona Starter Homes Act, continues to move. It recently cleared a House committee, and it's already been approved by the Senate. Last week, we heard from Yuma Mayor Doug Nichols about some of his concerns with the measure.
It gives essentially by right zoning to a lot of areas. And what that means is the planning that the cities have already done, the infrastructure investments, the forward-looking planning that we do as a city that we're responsible to our citizens for, goes out the window.
The bill has generated both bipartisan support and opposition. And today, we'll hear from its sponsor, Senator Shauna Bolick. The Phoenix Republican spoke with my co-host Mark Brody yesterday, who asked why she thinks the bill would help put a dent in the housing shortage the state is currently facing.
I have two children, and as a mother of two 20-somethings, this issue is really important to me because I want to make sure that my own kids have that opportunity for first-time homeownership. Warts and all, you know, it's not always fun being a homeowner, but I would love for them to be able to experience that. So just to give you some background on me, I have lived in a dormitory. I've lived in an apartment. I've lived in a condo. I've lived in a group home with other college students when I was a young 20-something. Heck, when I lived in New York City, I even lived at the Y at 92nd Street. So seeing how I have lived over the years and seeing how these kids these days are kind of struggling, Senate Bill 1229, the impetus behind it is only to really legalize small homes on small lots, period. And so I got elected first back in November of 2018. And I believe legislators have been working to address the affordable housing issue since I first got elected back in 2018. And at this point, I'm pretty fully invested in this issue. My son and his wife, I worry that they will potentially move to a different city because the lack of affordable housing options. My son just got married in January. His wife is a student over at Cronkite. So they're on their way to hopefully, you know, get into the market of buying a house pretty soon. And, you know, again, at the end of the day, I really don't want to get on an airplane to go visit my grandchildren. I know it's very selfish of me, but I know there's other individuals out there on the legislative side that feel the same way that I do. And working towards something small like this, I think is really the first step.
One of the criticisms that I'm sure you've heard of this bill, and you alluded to it, is that there's nothing necessarily in it that would make sure that the homes, these smaller homes on smaller lots, would in fact be more affordable. You know, there have been some calls to maybe put some provisions in there, make sure they are owner-occupied as opposed to investor-owned. I'm curious, what gives you the confidence that this bill will lead to more affordable homes?
So obviously, I don't have the magic wand and I don't have a crystal ball, but getting back to starter homes like they had, you know, 50 years ago, obviously that cuts the size of the house down pretty dramatically. It seems like when I've looked at different houses for sale, especially new homes, they start at like 2,500 square feet, 3,000 square feet. And, you know, when you're first starting out, you really don't need that room. You really don't need to have all that property to take care of. Yet, you know, we've obviously, you've noticed we have had some pushback with Senate Bill 1229. I think it's really unfair that we have taxpayer-funded lobbyists that come down to the Capitol, and they do protect those unelected bureaucrats that are sitting in those planning offices. I can tell you, if I was starting out as a 20-something, the last thing I would be worried about is what color the paint of my house should be, or whether or not I have a garage, or even what type of roof I have. But whenever new home buyers are typically going through that process with the municipal governments, they're telling them what they can and can't have, and they're dictating to them what their house is going to look like. And I really don't think that's fair. It'd be really great to get back to the way things should be, where, you know, you go in, you submit your plans, and then you go back and forth. But it seems to me that the cities have taken over design standards. I don't know what unelected bureaucrat should be in charge of design standards, but I can tell you, I don't think any should be. I think if it's your private property, you should be able to design a house looking the way exactly you want it to look without having to worry about what features should be dictated to you.
Well, so you brought up another concern that cities have brought up, which is that they say they're losing some of the rights and responsibilities that they have in terms of designing and lot sizes, things like that. I'm curious, though, about are you confident that, you know, builders, let's say this bill were to become law, would builders build homes that, you know, first-time home buyers like your son and his wife might be able to afford? Or is it possible that these could just be as unaffordable as so many other homes across the valley and across the state?
Well, obviously, if we were making sure that you have smaller homes on smaller lots, the home builders would really love to be able to get into this game again. They have told us repeatedly over the last several years that they're unable to get some of these things approved because of the city requirements on one side. The thing that I keep reminding myself is I was in my 20s whenever I bought my first house. Currently, the average age for a new home buyer is 38 years old, and the average cost of a house is approaching about $500,000 in the Phoenix metro area. I think we need to get back to making sure that the younger generation has that chance of home ownership again, And I feel like it's just getting further out of reach. Obviously, a lot of these kids, when they get out of school, they have debt. My son and his wife will not have any college debt. And it's crazy to think that whenever they show me some of the ads that they pull up for houses they might be able to afford. So one of the areas that they were looking at was over by the Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport in the flight path.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost $300,000 for, I think it was a 1,200 square foot house, which is an absolute teardown. I just can't believe that that's how crazy our market has gotten. I moved here in 2001. And if I had the resources back then, I would have definitely bought some farmland on the East Valley or West Valley, because at this point, those are the areas in which we're looking at to have these starter homes. They're not going to happen in Scottsdale. They're probably not going to happen in Phoenix, because the bill specifies that it's 5 acres and above. It's very hard to actually find a plot of land that actually fits that equation within the central Phoenix area or even Scottsdale that's affordable.
How big of a dent do you think this bill could potentially put in the housing crisis we're dealing with? Again, assuming that it passes the legislature and is signed into law.
If it helps even 15% of the young families that are hoping to buy a house, I would be really happy. You know, obviously, we've had a lot of opposition. We have amended the bills. We've had lots of stakeholder meetings with the cities. We've had stakeholder meetings with the governor's office as well to try to address their concerns. In my opinion, I really don't want to turn it back on this next generation. And I believe that supporting the Starter Home Act is probably the first step to address that issue.
Are you anticipating or would you welcome any additional changes at this point?
So we had a stakeholder meeting last Thursday after the bill went through the House Committee on Commerce. We are still trying to figure out if we need to amend the bill further or if it's good the way it is. We were supposed to have a stakeholder meeting earlier today, and the city folks declined the invitation, as did the governor's office. So I'm hoping that we're moving in the right direction. I'm hoping that within the next week, we get it up on the board for a vote, whether that includes an amendment or not, and then send it up to the governor's office for her signature.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Arizona Senator Shauna Bolick. Senator Bolick, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, sword swallowing is not an illusion. It is very real and very dangerous. We'll hear what drove one performer to attempt the death-defying feat. But first, last year, Maricopa County had more eviction filings than ever before, more than 87,000. An eviction is a complex crisis. It obviously takes an extreme personal toll on the person being evicted, as well as their families. But then there's the landlord, who's often lost thousands of dollars of revenue, and the logjam of cases making their way through the courts, and the heavily burdened social safety net, which is straining to keep up with the influx of people who find themselves abruptly facing homelessness. KJZZ's senior field correspondent, Katie Davis-Young, has been reporting on the eviction boom here in the Valley for months, and she joins me now to talk about what she's found. Katie, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for being here. I wanted to start by just having you talk about one of the experiences you had reporting this, which was sitting and listening to recordings of eviction proceedings. You listened to many hours of these. What did you gather from that experience?
Yeah, I think there's two things that are striking when you listen to these recordings. And one is just the speed and the volume of these cases. They're mostly done by phone, and they're booked just back to back to back. Judges hear dozens of cases at a time, and they might last just like a minute or two each. They kind of just run through them one after the other. And so then the other thing that strikes me listening to all these cases at one after the other is the stories people tell and just how many people there are out there in Maricopa County who are living paycheck to paycheck and who one thing goes wrong for them and that's what leads them to not be able to pay rent. So there is actually data on this from the Joint Center for Housing Studies at Harvard, which says more than half of renters now in Maricopa County are paying more than 30% of their income toward housing. That's what's considered affordable. So if you are a renter in Maricopa County, it's more likely than not that you are actually living outside your means.
Yeah.
And for more than a quarter of renters in Maricopa County, they're spending more than half of their income on housing these days. So that's just really not sustainable for people. And if one thing goes wrong, they could end up before a judge.
Yeah, we hear this idea of people living paycheck to paycheck as sort of a talking point. But one of the things that comes through in the piece is how real that experience is and how fast, in one of these very brief proceedings, your whole reality can change. And in that same vein, one of the other really memorable parts of your reporting on this is you do this ride-along with a constable named Mahogany Kennedy, who is serving writs of eviction. Talk a little bit about that experience.
Yeah, I spent about half a day with the constable going around in South Phoenix doing evictions. One thing that was kind of interesting is just most of the doors that she knocked on, no one was home. By the time a writ of restitution is there, the tenant knows usually that they have to vacate the property. So they've already left by the time she shows up. But we did knock on one door where the family was still there. This was a small two-bedroom apartment, and there were 9 people inside, 3 adults, 6 children, also a dog and a guinea pig. And as soon as you opened the door, I could see there were no moving boxes, no suitcases. The tenants knew that they were being evicted, but they had not prepared to leave, so they had about 20 minutes to just grab essentials for a few days, cell phones, medications, diapers for the smallest child, coats for the kids. And then they would have 2 weeks to arrange time to come back for the rest of their stuff. But it was this extremely tense scene. There was yelling, there was crying. You can see how this is just utter upheaval for people who go through this very stressful experience.
Yeah. Well, one of the folks that you profile in your pieces on this is a woman named Danielle. And hearing what you've been describing, I could imagine some folks listening to this and imagining that the landlords in these stories are kind of the villains, and Danielle is somebody who gets evicted. But from what I understand, as she told you and you gathered from other folks you spoke to, the landlords, it's a little bit more of a nuanced story.
Well, yeah, you mentioned Danielle. She's almost 60 years old. She was evicted after being laid off from her job, and she ended up homeless. She's been in a homeless shelter now almost a year. And when she talks about that experience, like you say, yeah, she doesn't direct her anger really at the landlords. She understands that she didn't have any income, and so the rental company tried to work with her, but, you know, she didn't have any money to pay to stay there. But she really gets frustrated talking about those few weeks that came after that. She feels like Arizona's court process for evictions was so fast that she wasn't able to get the help that she needed, and that she shouldn't have ended up in a homeless shelter, that there wasn't enough of a safety net to keep her housed.
Well, as you can tell from what Katie's been saying, this is a very human story, and we encourage you to check out Katie's reporting on our website. That is Katie Davis Young, our KJZZ senior field correspondent, who has been reporting on this issue for several months. Katie, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. An investigation from the Arizona Republic finds between January 2021 and last November, Phoenix police officers pointed guns at people more than 19,000 times. And in nearly 1,600 of those instances, the person having the gun pointed at them was between the ages of 2 and 17. This comes as the department has been scrutinized by the U.S. Justice Department over its use of force policies. The agency released a scathing report based on its 3-year probe last year. Sahana Jayaraman reported and wrote the investigation in The Republic. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked if it was a challenge to get as complete and accurate data on these incidents as possible.
The data itself that I analyzed is actually, it's publicly available. It's posted to the City of Phoenix's open data portal. It purportedly contains a row for every time a Phoenix police officer has pointed a gun at someone. But I found that some of the families that I was speaking to, the Dodd family in particular, is saying that Phoenix PD pointed guns at them. The Dodd family doesn't show up in the data, which does raise questions about how complete and accurate the actual data set is.
What are some of the reasons why a police officer might point a gun at somebody?
From the police department, a spokesperson told me in an email that sometimes gunpoint incidents happen when a police officer has their gun up and covering a quote unquote threat area. And somebody, quote unquote, incidentally or quote unquote, unexpectedly appears in that threat area. And I found that, you know, sometimes pointed gun incidents involving children happen when adults put those children's safety at risk. In one of the examples that I wrote about in my story, a special assignments unit from the Phoenix Police Department pointed their guns at two women holding toddlers in an apartment while they were serving a search warrant. They were serving the search warrant because they were looking for an 18-year-old man who also lived in that apartment who was suspected of killing somebody at a Phoenix park 3 days earlier. But one of the most difficult things for me to get answers to was why these incidents happen. That information is often contained within police records and police reports, and the Phoenix Police Department is very slow to release those records and reports when they release them at all.
Well, so you also spoke with some criminology experts about this. What did you hear from those experts who looked at this data? Like, what did they have to say about what you found?
You know, none of them had looked at this data, this specific Phoenix Police Department's data, in depth before. There were really varied perspectives on what I found and what it meant. Michael Scott, who is the director for the Center for ASU Center for Problem-Oriented Policing and was a former police chief, said that without looking at every single report, the existence of the problem couldn't be identified. You know, Michael Sierra Arevalo, who wrote the book The Danger Imperative, said that he thought the way to reduce pointed gun incidents was to reduce the number of total contacts that police have with the community. And Justin Nix, who was one of the researchers who originally suggested that Phoenix PD track this stat at all, said that, you know, this would be thousands of incidents of uses of force that the public wouldn't know about without the tracking of that data. So really varied perspectives on what the data meant and whether there was a problem with how Phoenix police officers are pointing guns at people and children.
Is there a sense of how what you found in Phoenix compares to police departments in other cities in terms of the frequency with which they point guns at children?
So that was one thing that I sort of had difficulty parsing out. As Michael Scott said, and as Justin Nix has written in some of his research, the collection of this data across the country is a relatively new thing. There isn't a ton of basis on which to compare the data. There are other very large cities who do collect this information. I think Cleveland, Chicago, Baltimore, Dallas, they all have their officers track when they point guns at people, and they all implemented that policy before Phoenix did. So it's not like Phoenix is the only city that does this, but it's certainly not like something as old or as frequently done as tracking, say, like officer-involved shootings.
What do Phoenix Police Department guidelines or regulations or rules say about when it is appropriate or when it is okay to point a gun at somebody?
So the Phoenix Police Department actually doesn't have a policy about when that specifically outlines when it's appropriate to point a gun at someone. And this was one of my most surprising finds personally early on. I just kind of assumed, I think as a layperson, that the Phoenix Police Department and all police departments really would have a policy about when it's okay to like pull a gun and point it at someone, but they don't. And the Phoenix Police Department is not the only department that doesn't have a policy. Just within the state, I think, you know, I looked at Mesa, Glendale, Scottsdale. I don't think any of those three have a specific policy about when officers can pull guns either. I know Chandler does. I know Tucson does. So there are departments out there that have policies you know, more explicitly outlining when it's okay for officers to point guns at people. But Phoenix PD is not one of them.
Do police officers get in trouble for pointing guns at kids, especially if the kids have nothing to do with a crime that's being committed?
According to the Justice Department, they do not. The Justice Department didn't say much about police gun pointing in its 3-year investigation on the Phoenix Police Department, but it did say that the police supervisors charged with reviewing certain types of force incidents, including gun points, do not adequately essentially like look at officer tactics or the force used, and that, you know, Phoenix PD supervisors essentially okayed all of the incidents of gunpointing between 2021 and 2022, and there were thousands of them.
Did the police department or even maybe the union representing the officers dispute that?
Not to me. They did not. In their statements about the DOJ, the city of Phoenix did say that the police department, about the DOJ investigation, the city of Phoenix did say that the police department was materially different than the department investigated. But whether or not that is true remains to be seen.
Sahana Jayaraman reported and wrote the investigation in the Arizona Republic, headlined "Terror at Gunpoint." Here's how often Phoenix police are aiming guns at kids.
Every morning before work, I spritz myself with a misty blast from a bottle marked Bourbon Vanilla. Now, I've never really given much thought to why I do this, but I do know that I'm not alone. Countless people put on some sort of intentional scent before they head out into the world. Saskia Wilson-Brown has thought a lot about this. She is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Art and Olfaction, an organization dedicated to expanding public awareness about the culture of smell. She and her team are particularly interested in the work of independent artisan and experimental practices with scent. When I spoke with Saskia last year, she told me much of this experimental spirit can be traced to an internet culture that encourages people to re-examine preconceived notions about all sorts of human expression, from music and movies to colognes and perfumes.
The folks that started examining perfume started to rightfully question why it was that we were all meant to wear flowers if we were girls, and whatever, resins if we were boys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And started to re-examine that completely by making scents that were designed only to delight themselves and their own curiosities and their own sense of self.
Do you wear perfume yourself?
I wear multiple perfumes all the time.
What are some of your favorite scents to wear?
You know, I've been really interested in some fragrances that are, I guess, considered maybe a little bit odd from a classical perspective, like a brand called Beaufort London. All of his scents have this very specific aesthetic, which is a little bit dark wave, if I could describe it in one word. Okay. They're a little bit smoky and a little bit rough. And I wouldn't say that they're pretty, but they're definitely interesting.
When you put on, say, a dark wave scent like that, do you think you could describe the conscious effect it has on you? I ask because I started wearing cologne at some point because I associated it with a sense of a certain type of man that I thought I wanted to be.
Well, totally.
Who was like finished. You know what I mean? It was around the time that I started thinking, you know, I should get my hair cut every 6 weeks and I should wear collared shirts every day. And there was something about cologne that felt like the last step in that process.
100%. And so I echo that narrative. You know, when I was a young teenage girl, I sort of started to think, oh, like what is a woman? You know, what does a woman wear? And I also had the same narrative as you. I started, or the same thought process as you. You know, you wear certain clothes and at some point you put on a perfume because that's what the ladies smell like and you want to be a lady, you know. So, you know, I mean, as we age and our sense of identity evolves, you know, we get to explore different aspects of ourselves. So for me, wearing something by Beaufort is wearing something that explores a different aspect of my personality. It also conveys something different to the people around me. Versus, oh, I want to be a lady and I want you to think I'm attractive. It says, hey, I'm a complex being with stormy brains or whatever. I mean, it could say all sorts of things that are a little bit more complex than, oh, look at me, I'm a pretty girl.
You know what I'm just realizing as we're talking about this, and I wonder if you have any relationship with this, is I think maybe on some level, I don't know if it was conscious, but the reason that I started wearing cologne is it almost strikes me as a way to be remembered. People remember the smells of places they've been or foods they liked or, you know, things that they have a positive relationship with. Mm-hmm. And I think on some level it occurred to me that if somebody remembered, oh yeah, I met that guy once, he smelled good.
Yeah.
They might be less quick to forget me.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, isn't all human expression a desire not to be forgotten, you know?
Yeah. I mean, obviously one's sense of smell and what smells good to someone is extremely personal and is built out of a whole host of factors. What are some of the things that go into what we respond to favorably when we smell something that we're maybe not thinking about when we have a positive reaction?
I think the thing we most commonly don't think about is how culture plays its part, you know. So in some cultures, you know, for instance, the smell of the body is more accepted than others, you know, and in the US in particular, we've been sort of marketed deodorants from the early 20th century. And that marketing strategy was built on giving, I mean, overtly and admittedly built on instilling in people a sense of shame about how they smelled. I think people forget that. And a lot of the narratives around what smells good and smells bad, if you pick them apart, you know, you definitely come down to, you know, othering. When you have a dominant culture and you have a culture that is, you know, perceived as lesser by that dominant culture, oftentimes that language is spoken through smell. Those people mm-hmm. smell bad. Their food yeah. smells bad. They don't wash, blah, blah, blah. But if you just take a little bit of a curious nose to that and you remove the judgment, which you observe is this is just a smell, you know, it's, there's nothing wrong with any smell. It's just how you react to it, really.
Well, so, I think a lot of that history and reality helps explain things like floral scents that were associated with women and maybe like, I don't know, earthier, muskier forms of cologne that men used to wear. But let's talk a little bit about the journey from those to some of the fragrances that we can find now. You were alluding to one earlier with the Beaufort line. Mm-hmm. I was just looking up a couple here that I wanted to run by you. One is a scent called Inexcusable Evil.
By Tuscovet.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, so you're familiar.
Oh, okay. I'm familiar. Oh, yes.
It says the top notes are gunpowder and ozone. The heart notes are blood, bandages, iodine, burning flowers, fallen concrete, rain, incense, and sandalwood. Talk a little bit about the thought process in assembling a scent like that.
Well, I mean, this particular perfume was assembled as a sort of political statement as to, you know, to what's going on in the world. Human misbehavior, war, evil, you know, what we do mm-hmm. to each other. And all the scents, all the scent notes that you describe are designed to elucidate that. It's a political and it's an artistic statement. And it's not always pleasant, much like art isn't always pleasant, but it makes a point.
Right. It's kind of an audacious idea, the idea that you would wear a scent like this. And it, you know, it's doubtful, I would imagine, that you could walk up to somebody wearing Inexcusable Evil and stand next to them and say, is that the smell of fallen concrete? Boy, there's a lot of genocide happening, you know?
Yeah, I mean, not your common perfume narrative, for sure.
but I could imagine standing next to somebody wearing that and having them say, I'm so sorry, that scent you're wearing is so interesting, tell me more about it. And then that becomes an invitation to have that conversation.
Exactly. And so the perfumer, whose name is David Love, is from Romania. And that was the point.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one more I wanted to run by you is called Funerie, and this is by Pinewood Perfume.
Yeah.
And the scent notes here are rites of the dead, a shroud of bleakness, feasting fungi and wilted roses nestle atop charred pine boards and a base of heavy resins, morel mushroom, decayed rose, blood cedar, rotting wood. What do you make of wanting to evoke death?
Yeah, well, so I think that death is a reality. And I think that traditionally in perfumery, we would have done everything to avoid that reality because, you know, who wants to be confronted with death? We'd rather just smell nice. So there's this sort of small subset of indie perfumes that explore death, typically in metaphor, as this one does, I might add, because the real smell of death is not in this fragrance. I can guarantee you that.
Right.
I think it's just like it's humans making sense of our human condition, you know, and all with all the tools we have at our disposal. And I think it's cool that perfume has evolved to the point where we can do that now.
Yes. But it just occurs to me, based on what you said, that even in a scent like Funerie, we still can't resist romanticizing it.
Absolutely. I mean, this is definitely the realm of metaphor. I mean, at least that's what I'd say perfumers hope, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, religion, power, sensuality, you name it. It all has an olfactory narrative.
All right. Well, Saskia Wilson-Brown is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Art and Olfaction and the host of the Perfume on the Radio radio show. Saskia, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sam. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Good morning and welcome back to the show. On KJZZ 91.5, I'm Sam Dingman. Dan Meyer arrives at the studio with a long, narrow black bag. As we're getting settled, he takes a moment to compliment one of our producers.
Kirsten, by the way. Sorry. Hi, Kirsten. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
That's an awesome sweater.
Oh, thank you. I got it for Halloween.
Kirsten's sweater has a picture of a skeleton's ribs on it.
I need to get one of those. It shows where everything goes.
Right. There you go. Dan Meyer is a sword swallower. He was a top 50 finisher on America's Got Talent, and he's in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Ask anything you want. Okay. I've probably been asked it a few times before.
He's in his 60s, thin and stylishly dressed, with dancing eyes and a perpetual grin. Before we get underway, Dan takes a moment to run a brush through his mop of blonde hair.
The first 20 years of my life, I grew up in extreme fear. I would shake and stutter. I couldn't talk very well.
Because of this, Dan says, he got bullied a lot. Kids would call him names and beat him up.
So I vowed, as a little kid, I wanted to do things the bullies could not do. I wanted to do real magic, do real feats. I wanted to be like a superhero and fly around the world doing superhuman feats and saving lives.
When Dan was 20, he was living in India as a Lutheran missionary. It was 115 degrees during the day. So at night, when the temperature dropped, he and his friend Greg would sit on the roof of the bungalow where they were staying. And one night, Greg asked Dan a question.
He said, "Do you have thromes, Daniel?" I said, "Thromes? What are thromes?" With an M.
Uh-huh.
And he said, "Thromes come from a book called The Thromes of Errol of Sherrill."
According to Dan, thromes are major life goals.
Like, if you could go any place you want to go, do anything you want to do, be anyone you want to be, where would you go, what would you do, who would you be?
That night, Dan lay on the roof, looking up at the stars, trying to make a list of thromes. Eventually, he drifted off to sleep.
And I woke up a few hours later, and my whole body was shaking and trembling. And this time, it wasn't with social anxiety disorder like it had as a kid. Come to find out, I had 105-degree malaria fever.
Dan says he was in and out of consciousness for 5 days, fighting for his life. And while it was a tiny mosquito carrying an even tinier parasite that had made him sick, Dan decided that his real problem was an emotional parasite.
And in a moment of clarity, I realized that fear was my kryptonite that had crippled and paralyzed me my entire life.
Dan beat malaria, and the night his fever broke, he made his list of thromes.
I wanted to live on a deserted island, wanted to live on a ship on the ocean, wanted to live with a tribe of Indians, wanted to visit the seven wonders of the world, visit all the major continents, work with a circus, work in the music business in Nashville, climb to the top of the highest mountain in Sweden, see Mount Everest at sunrise, jump out of an airplane. I think there might have been a couple more in there.
Now, we don't have time to get into how it happened, but Dan actually did end up doing a lot of that stuff, including the circus part. In 1987, he moved to Nashville, and he started a group called the Music City Jugglers Club.
And we juggle every Tuesday night, had about 30, 35 of us passing clubs. And this van pulls up, and it had a bunch of sideshow performers in it. One of them was Tim Cridland, who goes by Zamora the Torture King. And the other one was George the Giant, George MacArthur from Bakersfield, California. He's 7'3", and he was a sword swallower.
George the Giant told Dan that there were only 12 living sword swallowers in the entire world. "It's incredibly dangerous," George said. George personally knew of 29 people who had died doing it. He told Dan not to try it. Instead, Dan put sword swallowing on his list of thrones. He went out, bought a sword, and started practicing.
I'd practice three or four times in the morning, three or four times in the afternoon when I'd come home from work. I was working in the music industry. And before I went to bed, brush my teeth and practice three or four times. You know, I felt sick to my stomach every time I did it.
4 years, and by Dan's count, 14,000 attempts later, he still hadn't gotten the sword down his throat. He says he used to stare at diagrams of the esophagus on the wall at the doctor's office, trying to figure out what he was doing wrong. Finally, he went out and bought a copy of Gray's Anatomy.
And I found out what you have to do to get a sword down the throat is you have to go over into the oral cavity in the mouth, over the tongue, repress the gag reflex in the back of the throat, navigate a 90-degree turn down the upper esophagus through the cricopharyngeal upper esophageal sphincter, here right behind your Adam's apple, your voice box. Then you have to repress the peristalsis reflex, the 22 pairs of muscles that swallows the bolus of your food down into your stomach. Slide the blade down into the chest chamber, the thoracic chamber between the lungs. Nudge the heart aside to the left.
Nudge your heart to the left.
Occupational hazard, yeah. Piece of cake. Don't try it at home.
I certainly won't. Dan claims that when he swallows a sword, there's only an eighth of an inch of esophageal tissue separating it from his heart.
I'll have volunteers pull a sword out and they can feel the blade, you know, thumping on my heart.
Oh,
and I can
my
feel
God.
I can feel their hand shaking on my heart as well.
So oh my God.
It's really a profound feeling.
This is the point in our conversation where Dan reaches down, unzips the long black bag he brought along with him, and pulls out what looks like a pirate sword.
This is a single-edged cutlass. This one I got here in Mesa at a sword shop.
Dan says when he walked into the shop, he told the guy behind the counter that he swallowed swords. If he could swallow that cutlass, Dan asked, would the guy give it to him for free? The guy said it was a pretty expensive sword, but if Dan could prove he was really a sword swallower, maybe he'd give him a discount. So Dan took the sword off the wall, ran his tongue along the blade to moisten it, and slid it down his throat.
And about that time, I felt it start to burn.
Okay.
And I thought, uh-oh, I think I punctured something. It was burning really bad. My throat started to swell up. I went home and drank as much ice water as I could, as many vitamins, took Theraflu and everything I could to knock myself out and see if I could sleep for 12 hours that night. I sat up in bed spitting blood into a bucket for like 3 days.
Oh, my God.
And I almost died from that one. And then I did what any normal red-blooded sword swallower would do, is I went back and I bought that sucker, and I'm going to swallow it for you right here.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, so this is the sword that caused that, and it is going down Dan's throat. It's about halfway down, and now it is all the way down. He's got his arms outstretched. And now he is making a sawing motion as he pulls it out and appears to be completely unharmed.
That's it.
I don't know if you've ever watched somebody swallow a sword, but I'm here to tell you, even if you have just received a detailed explanation of how it works, it's a little hard to believe it's actually happening. But what seems obvious is that Dan has never doubted his ability to do it. It was a throne, and Dan has a vow to uphold. These days, Dan is working on a new throne, and it's even more high stakes. In 2022, he went in for a colonoscopy, and the doctors found 6 cancerous tumors.
I rubbed my hands together and I said, oh good, this is going to be great. This is another challenge to beat.
Speaking of hard to believe,
for the past 2.5 years, I've been no chemotherapy, no radiation. I've been taking about 100 supplements a day. We've shrunk down 5 of the tumors. I've got 1 left.
Well, wait, can I just ask, the supplements that you're taking, is that what you attribute the shrinking of the tumors to?
Quite a bit of it, yeah. It's
what supplements are they?
Turmeric, or ivermectin, fenbendazole, just a bunch of different things that are known to shrink cancer or fight cancer or starve cancer.
And did you do this? Was this a situation where the doctors recommended chemo and you decided to do this instead?
Exactly. A little doctor from South India said, oh, we need you to come in tomorrow morning. We're going to put a hole in into your heart, a port into your heart. We're going to start you on chemo for 16 weeks. And I'm like, I can't do that. He said, why not? I said, well, I'm going to do Alaska State Fair and then Eastern Idaho State Fair and then Sweden's Got Talent. And I can't do that. I can't be sick to my stomach and losing my hair. I've got gigs to do.
I should note here that the New York Times recently reported a surge in misinformation about ivermectin. To quote from the Times piece, there is no rigorous research showing the drug cures cancer in humans. But Dan has always been someone who trusts his own experience, ever since that night on the roof, when his friend Greg asked him if he had any thromes. If he hadn't asked you that question that night, who do you think you would be today?
I would probably still be in fear.
Well, if, in the words of Saskia Wilson Brown, all human expression is a desire not to be forgotten, we don't take it lightly that you spent part of your morning with us here at the show. We encourage you to bring a curious nose to the rest of your day, and we'll be right back here tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. For Lauren Gilger and Mark Brody, I'm Sam Dingman. We'll talk to you then.